What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Stormcrow Comic Cast. Super bonus, double size, one-shot collector's item, Days of Future Past special. Yes, that's right. Epic. Epic. Yes. So we're doing it. We got Uncanny X-Men 141 and 142 in front of us.
Did you say who you were?
Well, I'm Ruben G, man.
I'm Kevin Merrill.
Well, it's nice to meet you.
We're the Stormcrow Comic Cast.
We are that.
I don't know who he is. We are in front of a live audience.
Yeah, that's right. One of like these great iconic covers. I think both covers of these two issues are pretty awesome.
Uncanny X-Men 141.
Yeah, yeah. If you're not looking at it, you know, of course, Wolverine in front of Kate Pryde, Wall with the spotlight and the sort of hit list of different, you know, X-Men and heroes and whatnot, slain, apprehended, you know, Wolverine free at large or whatever. But anyway, so really one of those big issues. Chris Claremont, was it John Byrne?
Yeah. John Byrne, yes.
Yeah. Sort of.
Terry Alston inking. Very, very fantastic inker.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're giving cred because I wasn't really. I've got a black and white issue here. No, I don't. But, yeah. You know. you know, one of the things in this book is like all the parallels to the Holocaust, to, you know, that sort of oppression. There's a lot of these dark urban cityscapes and, you know, they go through it. And of course, most comic fans are loosely familiar with the storyline that, you know, the Sentinels have taken over and, mutants are hunted down and they're separated from society in internment camps.
It is quite literally the mutant Holocaust.
Right. Right. Yeah. So the actual opening of the, 141, you know, this is New York, the Big Apple. Once upon a time, it was a nice place to live. It is no longer. The street is Park Avenue in the upper 70s. When Kate Pryde was a child, it was one of the swankiest neighborhoods in the city, if not the world.
Swank.
Now it's swank. A slum. Abandoned, derelict, dying, much like the city, the country, the planet around it. Welcome to the 21st century.
Yeah, and just as a quick note, I think they end up saying at some point in the story, but this is said in the year 2013. So thank God we dodged that bullet. Thank God.
Yeah, well, that's a okay. Good way to look at it. You know, I always imagine, I don't know if you remember Conan O'Brien, in the year 2000. Yeah. Anyway.
I do remember that with the flashlight.
Yeah, right, right. Darken the stage. Yeah. And love it. So, you know, Kitty's running through the state, or Kate, and I've had trouble with this, but I think it's useful to sort of separate the two Catherine Prides or whatever. You know, Kate refers to at least the consciousness of this 2013 Catherine Pride.
Yeah.
And when we say Kitty, we should at least, I know I'm going to mess it up, but we should be referring to the one back in 1980. Of course, when the book came out and when the alternate timeline the story's taking place in.
The present timeline for what will be a lot of it. Although I guess they do go to the future a lot. Yeah.
And she's running through the city and on a rendezvous with Logan. They've got a secret mission they're doing. Now, initially, she actually falls through a trap door into the lair of the Rogues, who are like a gang in this future, you know, world. This guy, he calls himself Big Alex, I think. Kind of funny looking, you know. He's got a red mohawk and then this yellow face paint that
feathers too. He's got some feathers going on.
Sort of a Native American thing, maybe. But I don't know. It looks kind of hokey.
Yeah, it's very, even though set in the future, it's a very 1980 design.
Yeah, yeah, obviously. You know? Yeah, totally. Totally. It's humorous. The art in this book is good. I really do like this art, but it is dated. So it's not really its fault. But
as far as like fashion choices and things like that. Yeah.
But I mean, you know.
But the quality of John Byrne's art is eternal.
It's good. I mean, it really is. It's great stuff. Anyway, so, you know, she doesn't have her powers. She's got these collars on that all the mutants have to have these collars. And it dampens their powers. So she is not able to phase in and out through walls and such as she usually would be. She gives a swift kick to the cojones on Big Alex and shows she's still got something to fight with, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, then Logan shows up.
Exactly.
And
with gray hair.
With gray hair, yeah. His temples are gray. There's, I think, Colossus in this book is the same way. Everybody looks like Reed Richards or Hal Jordan or something. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm like, who am I looking at?
With like the black, blue, yeah, and white hair.
That's right. That's right, yeah. And Logan is cool in here. And this is one of the outfits that I don't think is dated. I think he looks B.A. here. You know, sort of the leather jacket or like a bomber jacket, I guess. Yeah. And, you know, the gloves, he's got blue jeans on, snapping his knuckles and, looking for some action. And, you know, I wonder if he could, you know, do you think Wolverine's mutant powers include the ability to pop in and out his claws? Are the claws, I mean, the claws I would think of as part of his mutation.
The claws are, yeah, because so, remember originally they were just, they were bone claws.
Right, right, right.
So.
They put the adamantium on top of it.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you would consider the ability to pop them in and out part of his powers. And I ask that because if he can either, and I'm not sure here, but if he could reveal his presence by using his powers or he's not wearing a dampener collar.
Right.
But if he was, I wonder if that would affect his ability simply to pop the claws in.
I would think so. I think that's tied into the total package as far as him being a mutant.
Yeah. So there you go. I was just curious.
So.
They get out of here and we get a little bit of a look at sort of what the mission is. Logan apparently is working in the Canadian Resistance Army and he's gotten
which
word.
Which does not sound intimidating
this
at all.
Does not, yeah.
I'm sorry, Canada, but but come on.
Yeah. Well, they're very polite. They post their threats in two languages. And,
yeah.
You know, they're good people. Perhaps not intimidating, but, you know, he's gotten word that, there's a big resistance out, not just sort of the X-Men against the Sentinels. They're a threat to the entire world.
Right.
And, the word from London is that everything's on automatic. The moment the Sentinels move out of North America, the other great powers will launch a full scale nuclear strike. So they've got sort of a deadline. They've got to figure out stuff to avoid this nuclear war. And they're putting together a device. Logan delivers to her a little piece of what they're calling the jammer.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the jammer is actually going to be able to shut the dampeners off. So they won't have to take off the collars, but they'll be able to use their powers.
Right. Exactly. So that they can have, I guess, one less stand against the Sentinels and try to save the world from nuclear destruction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's sort of the deal here.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kate heads back to like her camp, basically a concentration camp. And, you know, we get this next page where they're sort of explaining the deal with the Sentinels and the deal with, you know, the law with mutants and that they're split into humans. Anomalous humans who have the genetic potential for mutation or something, and then straight up mutants, and the mutants are living in camps,
right?
And so she gets back to the camp, and you know, you get the scene with the graves of all these deceased X-Men.
A lot of absolutely, and not all X-Men too. Ben Grimm, Johnny Storm,
right.
Reed Richards. You got some of the Fantastic Four.
Yeah. Of course. Kurt Wagner, Warren Worthington, Scott Summers, and there's Chuck Xavier.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, it you know, a lot of sort of one of the criticisms perhaps for Claremont is just sort of how wordy it gets. And there's a lot of it. And at times it's really nice, but at times, you know, I think you could show what's going on through the art.
Right.
But certainly she's talking as she looks at, or she's thinking to herself in the anachronistic word bubbles, or not anachronistic, but they're, you know, we don't get those anymore. We were talking about that the other day. Like, what's so wrong with the word bubble?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, a thought bubble. Sorry. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
what's so wrong with the thought bubble?
It's kind of been replaced by the narrative boxes or whatever they have now in panels. But, you know, there is sort of a, I don't know. There's its own appeal of having a thought bubble, you know, it's, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm happy with the modern day kind of, you know, narrative boxes that you get or whatever. But
I think the problem Thought Bubble Store, kinda with cool. that, one of the things that just straight up Thought Bubbles allows you to do is get right inside two characters' minds on the same page.
Yeah.
And I think traditionally, if you have like a narrative box or panel or whatever, it would probably be confusing to have different perspectives on there on that same page. And it's like, okay, who's thinking this? Who's talking or whatever?
Yeah.
And this is just a simple way to show, okay, that's what they're thinking about. And that's what that guy's thinking about.
Well, I mean, you know, Batman titles do it sometimes, though.
Yeah, and they'll do the color change.
Exactly, yeah.
And, you know,
so there, you can color code it to make things a little bit easier, but
fair enough. Fair enough. I've never gotten why they just disappeared. Maybe it's just a design choice.
I think it just kind of slowly happened over time. Yeah. I don't think there was one particular, you know, month of comic book releases where they're like, okay, it's done. Just fell bubbles from now on. I think it was something that slowly just kind of fell out of favor.
But somewhere in the late 90s, I do think Senator Robert Kelly outlawed
He sent Sentinels out for all the comic writers still using Thought Bubbles. But you know what? I honestly wouldn't really be surprised to see like maybe some more like independent underground type comics maybe still using Thought Bubbles today. Just to kind of be retro or whatever about it.
You know, in getting back to this, but still this design... there's so much on each page. And one of the things we were talking about is I feel that like this storyline perhaps could have been stretched out a little bit.
It could have been,
you know, there's so much information. The art could have been so much bigger. And
that's definitely a very valid way to look at it. But also, you know, when we talked about this before, when I, you know, read through this story, I was kind of impressed by how much they got into two issues. Cause normally a story of this magnitude is at least like a 5 or 6 part event.
Do you think even at the time in the early 80s that would have been true? Or is this just the same for every Claremont book? Because honestly, what I've read, it seems like this is what he always did. He wasn't actually trying to cram
stories. I think this is very much so a Claremont thing because I think about things like Marvel Superhero Secret War was like a 10 or a 12 part series, you know, where you get like the origin of the black costume for Spider-Man and Secret Wars number 8, things like that. And that was at some point in the 80s too, as well. So, I think it definitely depended on the writer, but it's still though. My hat is in one respect is off to Claremont for being able to get so much in just two issues, you know? Cause I still felt like, even though I feel you when you mention something like, you know, well, you know, you could have stressed things out. Maybe instead of something happening just one single panel on a page, it could have been like a huge splash page or something like that. But on the other hand, it's very efficient, you know?
Perhaps. And there are still, I think, as we go through here, a couple of really nice big page panels and different nice bits we'll probably point out.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was sort of our little tangent. But, you know... Kate is making it back sort of to home base and meeting up with the other X-Men. And these are the only four that remain. Logan, Kate, Aurora, so Storm, Peter Rasputin, and Franklin Richards, last survivor of the fabled Fantastic Four. Who, you know, Franklin isn't he show up like in the Hickman books and stuff later on?
He does, yes.
That's right. And I guess Franklin has hooked up or married or whatever with Rachel, who they don't say Summers here, but this is supposed to be Rachel Summers.
It is.
Right?
I from what I understand, I'm not a huge X-Men reader, but from what I understand, this is one of her earlier appearances, if not her first appearance.
Is it the daughter of Madeline Pryor or... Do you know?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Like I said, not a big X-Men guy.
Yeah, okay.
But
whatever.
But I was talking to you know, my dad who owns Stormcrow, and he was saying that he thinks this is one of her first appearances, if not the first.
Okay. Yeah. Well, regardless, she is a telepath.
Yeah.
And, you know, so she may have gotten that directly from Jean Grey, or it may have just been, whatchamacallit, just a random mutation that she did get or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, Magneto's their leader, and, you know, they've got the M's on their suits here. They're all wearing the sort of jumpsuits for mutants.
Been labeled, yeah, exactly.
That's right. So she's bringing back the jammer, of course, and they're getting ready to make their next move. Knowing that nuclear war might be imminent, they've got to act now. And the plan is to switch consciousnesses. Kate is going to basically, her mind is going to go back in time to October 31st, 1980 and switch minds with her younger self. So I think I'm going to try and say Kate when I'm talking about Kate's consciousness and Kitty when I'm talking about Kitty's consciousness. Mm-hmm. If that makes any sense. No,
definitely. As she matured, she definitely went by, you know, Kate or whatever. Whereas Kitty is more of a...
It's a pet name. Or it's a pet nickname.
It implies youth, you know, kitten, to me. To me, kitten, Kitty. Yeah. So
and they call her a kitten sometimes.
Yeah.
So they go into a room. They put their jammer together. Whatchamacallit. Rachel sits down. Kate lies back on a mattress.
Air mattress?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's an air mattress, but I'm just going to say it's an air mattress because we have those in the year 2014 and also last year in 2013. And we're about to get one of those giant splash pages, by the way, that we were talking about earlier.
Yes, we are. So the seems she flung through time. I do like this little sort of last panel where it's like, you know, concentric blue and pink circles and she's being flung back through time.
Is that blue and pink?
You know, like a reddish pink.
I hate being colorblind.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe it's just red, but you know, on the page, it looks a little pink.
I'm certainly not going to challenge.
It's aquamarine. It's fuchsia. It's polka dots.
Okay.
There's polka dots on there. Being colorblind, I guess you can't see polka
dots. Okay. That completely changes the story for me.
That's right.
Well, let's start over from the beginning.
So we flash back.
Yeah.
To October 31st, 1980. And currently Kitty is in a danger room simulation. There's robots. This is a fun page. She's looking down the middle as Colossus keeps up this giant press. Wolverine's fighting a razor robot of sorts. Angels flying through, dodging missiles, and Storm dodging some kind of laser blast.
Kind of everyone being completely awesome in their moment, you know?
Yeah. Except for Kitty, who is a little bit sort of scared, and I don't know that she's done this before. I think she is new to the X-Men in this story.
Yes.
And they call her Sprite. She's going under that sort of old name of Sprite.
Yes, it's interesting that you bring up that she is new to the story, because I want to say... We're going through this in a trade paperback, and I want to say one of the issues that's part of this trade includes her first appearance as an X-Men.
Is this where she was met by Wolverine and whatchamacallit, it's like the beginning of the Dark Phoenix saga where, you know, Emma Frost is in there and.
Yeah, actually this is, that I'm not sure about. But 139, issue 139 was her, induction to the X-Men.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I've always liked her as a character. I mean, she's Jewish. That's cool.
Yeah.
And,
I like the caption too. Like her powers. Welcome to the X-Men, Kitty Pryde. Hope you survived the experience.
Yeah. That's fun.
You know, then just, you know, 2 issues later, she's all part of this Days of Future Past shenanigans.
Yeah, that's really interesting because they really were clever about integrating her into a story that was big and important and taking a central role. So that's
putting her in the spotlight pretty much right off the bat, just within a couple issues.
It's nice. So there's this big battle. Another thing about these comics is like, there's a lot of these action scenes where every little thing is explained both verbally and visually that you have to see every movement panel by panel and I'll use this power to dodge that and all the, you know.
Yeah. And classic Claremont.
Yeah. You get a little bit of this in this page as they're running through the danger room. You know, they're sort of under attack and the X-Men are worried that Kitty's going to get hurt. And so they're not really concentrating on what's going on. And at the last moment, Nightcrawler bamfs in, if you can call it that, and flips the emergency switch and saves them all from the danger room.
Help, so, I'm stepping into the danger room. I don't know the rest of the lyrics, I give up.
Nightcrawler approaches Kitty and, he's just trying to be nice and consoling, but kind of interesting. Kitty's very standoffish, so she doesn't really feel comfortable around him. Obviously, yeah. Nightcrawler is kind of a weird looking guy.
He is. He's got blue skin. He's got a pointy tail.
That's right. I think originally in Germany, they thought he was some kind of demon and they were trying to, you know, light his house on fire and stuff. He
poor
was
guy.
Having to run away when Professor X saved him. And so it's, you know, it makes sense that people who don't know him well would be a little bit uncomfortable about around him.
Kitty Pryde's a racist.
Hey, man, it's sort of racist to say that one race of people can't be racist.
Yeah.
So she could be. Anyway, so Kitty gets her junk together and does a simulation that Professor X has sort of put together for flawlessly. And everybody's sort of impressed and laughing that Professor X put so much effort into it. She finishes up and wham, wham, her consciousness. It is the moment they split, they switch, whatever.
The polka dot show back up, I assume. I can't see them because I'm colorblind, but.
Yes, there are those pretty blue and red concentric circles. Although, interestingly, I just noticed that in the first panel where Kate is going back in time, the predominant color is blue. Most of the circles are blue with a few red ones. And then it switches on the way out or whatever. It's mostly red concentric circles with a few blue ones in there.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So this isn't a big deal, but I didn't notice it before. And anyway, in real time, the body of the young Kitty, but of course the consciousness now of Kate, she drops. She just, something hits her. It's like she passes out. Everybody flips out and runs over to her. Kurt picks her up and gets her like to the infirmary or whatever. And when she wakes up, Kurt is the first person she sees. And she's like, what's going on? And Kurt's like, aha, our Fraulein is awake. And she leaps up to him and says, Kurt, it's you, really you, alive.
Yeah.
And like, this is Kate's consciousness.
Right.
Kurt has been dead for years, perhaps, in her reality. And so everybody immediately is like, WTF, what is going on? Because this is Kitty. She's scared of Kurt.
Yeah, because you have to remember, just, you know, a page or two ago, she was very standoffish and whatever. And now, you know, obviously this more mature Kate consciousness has got past his aesthetics or whatever. And you assume they become friends over time. And then, of course, she lost him at some point.
Yeah, she just loves him now. There's none of the, you know, sort of discomfort around his appearance or whatever. So everybody does know something's off. And she immediately dives into an explanation. This is a woman who has come through time in a war-torn area, and she gets right to the point, explains what's going on. And of course, they don't know what to believe, and they know there's really only one person who can get to the bottom of this, Professor X.
Sure.
So they need to get up with him. He is in Washington.
Poor guy. He is in Washington, indeed, though.
Yeah.
Basically, should we go through this kind of panel by panel of what's happening
this
here?
There's
a lot going on.
And I really do like this next page.
Yeah.
They're on, I think it's Warren Worthington's, you know, he's got some private jet or whatever. So they're flying out to Washington. Why aren't they using the Blackbird? Do they have the Blackbird now?
Don't know if they had it at this point.
Okay, because they're dressed as X-Men, so it's not like they're undercover. Anyway.
Yeah. Reminder, guys, I'm a Batman guy, not an X-Men guy.
I grew up with X-Men, though. Yeah. I was Marvel when I was
You were just being a disappointment right now, then.
Dude, all I read is Image these days.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're getting more exposition, and so they're on the plane, and Kate lets them know exactly why she's there. Storm is asking her, you say Kelly's death initiates a sequence of events, Kitty? What events? Kelly is a decent man with what he feels are legitimate concerns about the increasing numbers of superpowered mutants in the world. The Brotherhood killed him to teach humanity to fear and respect the power of Homo Superior. Their plan backfired. Mutants became objects of fear and hatred. So we know the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants is going to kill the presidential candidate, Senator Robert Kelly.
Yeah.
And they think it's going to, you know, lead to a better future. But obviously, that's not the case. Kate's here to stop the murder. Mm-hmm. you know, there's a, this next panel, you know, you were talking, we were talking about sort of the parallels to the Holocaust. Dude, this guy in front of the flag at the podium, I guess that's Kelly. No, that's not Kelly because he's dead. But he's also got gray at his temples. There are so many characters with gray at their temples. Oh, my God. Anyway, very Hitler-esque. He's got his arm out gesticulating. Yeah. It's not a Heil Hitler kind of thing. He's just pointing off. But it very much reminds me of that, you know, a flag hanging in the background.
Yeah, yeah, it's very reminiscent, I think. Right. I think they were definitely trying to imply that.
Yeah. You get the next panel showing it, you know, a bunch of sentinels standing, they're sort of inspecting them. And then it turns to both the mutants and the superheroes who supported the mutants,
yeah,
who got eliminated. The deal, what happened was, in 1984, a rabid anti-mutant candidate was elected to president. They passed the Mutant Control Act, and the Supreme Court strikes it down. But the administration, I guess this is kind of anarchy because they go against the Supreme Court and, you know,
White House won't ever do that.
The Sentinels.
White House won't ever do that. No.
They reactivate the Sentinels and just sort of put them on kill.
Yeah.
And the Sentinels conclude that the best way to kill the mutant menace, of course, is just to take over the country. And that's what happens. So that's what led to that future.
Right. And it all really starts, or it doesn't start, but it's definitely kicked into full gear with the death of Senator Kelly.
Yes.
Yeah, by the hands of the Brotherhood.
Yeah. And this sort of exposition shifts us back into 2013. It sort of transitions. They're in the, you know, 1980 and they're traveling. Kate explains all this, and then we revisit 2013 on the next page.
See Wolverine and the gang down in the looks like the subway system.
Yeah, that's
I think
right.
They say, yeah, this old subway tunnel's working like a charm. It'll take us to the heart of Manhattan and house Kate. So she's unconscious at this point.
At first, it really wasn't clear to me why they were moving anywhere. So, first of all, the thing worked. You know, their consciousnesses are switched, and these two timelines are sort of running in parallel to each other. It's not like a frozen moment. Kate goes back in time, and then when she comes, it's just going to be done. It's they're both running. And so, anyway, why are they moving? They have the unconscious body of Kitty Pryde, and I didn't really understand why they just weren't sitting still. Later on, they start making their way to the Baxter Building.
Well, keep in mind, I think they have to assume that maybe Kitty's not going to be successful. And so if she's not successful, they need to continue on with their own mission by taking down, getting everyone their powers back or what have you with the jammer. And taking down the Sentinels to prevent that nuclear war, just in case Kitty's not successful.
I was under the impression that they already had the jammer fully operational, which is why they were able to attempt the time travel in the first place. I thought that's what they needed to get Rachel's powers working, and I thought
I don't think it freed up everyone's powers, though, right? Because they have to get to the Baxter Building to try to shut down the Sentinels later in the story.
That is right, but I wasn't sure why they were moving here.
Yeah.
So anyway, regardless,
this is 2013. It's the future. Strange things happen in the future.
Yeah, that's true. And a strange thing happens right here in that a giant robot comes from above them.
Yeah.
And dude, this is an awesome panel on the end.
One of those that maybe kind of wish was a full like splash panel.
Yeah, there's several of these. I mean, unfortunately, the X-Men are not in for a fun time. But you know. The energy blast of the Sentinel obliterating Franklin Richards here. This sort of yellow light coming down, and his body is lit up so that it almost appears you can see the skeleton under his flesh.
Yes.
Wow. Yes. Oh, dude.
Sentinel sounds.
And this panel below it, another good one. The Sentinel's leaning over through the destruction and the energy sort of shining again.
Wow.
It's good stuff, man.
No, it really is, though. So they lose Franklin, like you said, and everyone is just completely horrified. Even Wolverine, if you look at the expression on his face at the bottom page, not calm at all. You know, he's very,
it's disgust and fear and shock and horror and just like, oh,
exactly. Even the Mr. Tough Guy Wolverine has something to worry about with these Sentinels. They're serious business.
Yeah. They sort of get their junk together pretty quick though.
They do.
Rachel hits the, lead Sentinel with a telekinetic blast. Storm comes in, shoots some lightning. Colossus armors up. Chucks Wolverine with the fastball special.
Yes, classic move.
That's right.
Those two.
He lands on the Sentinel's shoulder and tears up the side of his head with his claws. And does some real damage. And between the group of them, they're able to take the Sentinel down. Next page, really another fun one. Whatchamacallit, Colossus sort of wrecking ball his way through the bottom of this building so that it collapses on another following group of three Sentinels.
Yeah.
Kind of a cool moment there.
Absolutely. And, you know, just the kind of detail by John Byrne's really nice here too, because keep in mind, this is 1980. So there's not Photoshop to really enhance things. This is all done by hand, which I think is pretty darn impressive.
Yeah. It disappoints me if a lot of the popular artists do Photoshop. J.H. Williams doesn't. And if you say he does, I will come over this table. I'm getting up. I am getting right now. I'm getting up.
I won't say it, but I also won't say that he doesn't use Photoshop.
For now, that'll have to do.
So I'm just going to stand on that neutral position there.
Yeah. So they are headed to the Baxter building here. So, I mean, maybe they were before and I just had missed it, but we must push on. The Baxter building is the Sentinel's Continental Nerve Center. Destroy it and we can cripple them. So they're on the loose. Colossus thinking about Kate, who, of course, they're a couple, you know, Kate and Colossus. If you don't know out there, they've been.
It's business. It's business time.
Scene change.
It's a sing-along podcast.
To 1980.
Not back to 1980 with the Pentagon.
That's right.
And
Raven Darkhome.
I love this character. I got to read this character. I got to read it. This is the Pentagon, the largest building of this type in the world, command headquarters of the mightiest military machine that world has ever known. To many people, it is more truly representative, for good or ill, of the reality of America than the White House or Congress just across the Potomac River.
Yeah. So a military strength is, is more truly representative of our country than our, you know, democratically elected leadership.
Yeah.
So
kind of a, you know, they didn't outright say it, but they.
It is a sort of maybe anti-military kind of sentiment that, you know, it's being critical that we value or the military is a bigger part of us than our democracy or our civilian leadership at the very least. So perhaps, it's kind of interesting. It's not, you know, ham fisted, I don't think.
No.
But it is in there.
You can kind of read between the lines a little bit though.
That's right.
Deep within this man-made labyrinth, we find a young woman named Raven Darkholm. Now, do you have any idea who Raven Darkholm is?
I think I might.
Think you might? All right,
yeah, well, she's Mystique.
I don't know. I guess we're going to have to read ahead and see if you're right.
Yeah, it's two panels down, so I think. I spoiled two panels down, you know.
Well, you still owe me $5.
That's right. And, you know, if she's in the Pentagon, then I'll point out, because she joins up with the rest of the Brotherhood, and they're all in the Pentagon. Like,
yeah, somehow they got in just fine.
They got in fine, man. She's got her like little shape changing ability being all undercover.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think the Blob can change shape like that.
Maybe they're in the waiting lobby somewhere.
Yeah. Before you actually have to check ID. The part of the Pentagon where they don't need to see your ID.
Right. Yeah.
Which I don't think exists.
Maybe in 1980.
This next page, he's talking about how he got busted out of prison. Anyway, the Brotherhood is actually constituted of course, Mystique, the shape changer. You've got Avalanche, whose touch crumbles any solid object, creating an irresistible avalanche tidal wave effect with earth, stone, steel, anything. Pyro, who controls living flame. Destiny, a blind precog with the psychic ability to see the future. The only member of the Brotherhood Raven calls friend, which I didn't know. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And lastly, but not least, the Blob. Only recently escaped from prison. a man whom no physical force can harm. So anyway, he just got out of prison. He's like, oh, let's go hide out in the Pentagon. And, you know, I'm a mutant super villain. Like,
just gonna chill right here in the middle of military command.
That's right. They squabble here, you know.
You hide in plain sight.
Yeah, that's about as plain as it gets. But they start squabbling. Everybody's like, you know, sort of throwing their chest out here.
Yeah.
Mystique gets a handle on him, but you wonder if she was as capable a leader as Magneto would be.
Right. And they bring that up. It's very clear that not everyone's on board with Mystique necessarily.
That's right. She's sort of being challenged.
As I believe they actually say, wow, I hope that didn't make it onto the microphone. I think they call her like a broad at some point or something like that.
Broad.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But it is.
Here it is. Blob.
Yeah.
I just don't take orders from a broad. He says it's nothing personal or whatever. And I appreciate you breaking me out or whatever.
I'm just a misogynist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sorry. I'm still a villain.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
That's right. The next page, we are at the Senate and Senator Robert Kelly is addressing the body. They're having hearings. Professor X and Moira MacTaggert, who I believe, and now I know not to ask you this, but I think that's Banshee's wife. I think it's Banshee's wife, one of the older.
It's a good thing we did a bunch of research
diving
into this.
That's right.
But you know what? I think it's okay to come at this with the perspective of people who haven't read, you know, issues X-Men 1 through 140 to get to this point.
Well, I have, and I'm just testing you with all these times I look like I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
I'm really just testing you. And dude, I'm kind of unimpressed. You know, you gotta kick it up a notch.
You know, I always love it. This very minor tangent, but I always love it when people are like, "Well, you work in a comic shop, you should know everything." Yeah. It's like, do you know how many hundreds of thousands of stories there are out there? And I'm just supposed to know about them all. It's a ridiculous assumption a lot of people make.
It's kind of your job, though.
No, it's not. My job is to get Amazon online orders ready, is to run that register, and to keep Ruben in line. That's my job description.
I don't know, man.
And also play HeroClix.
That's right.
So and record podcasts on an almost daily basis now.
So Kelly is talking about the danger that mutants, might have for Homo sapiens. And of course, in these comics, they're very fond of, you know, Homo sapiens, normal humans, Homo superior. That's always been the way they referred to mutants. They're the name of their species or whatever, but I love it. You know, it's brought up.
I do think it's interesting though. Because a lot of the times when you think about people who are prejudiced against others, they don't always necessarily think of the people that they are prejudiced against as being better than them, but lesser than them. So I think it's interesting that they're not looking at these mutations as a flaw that puts them beneath the human race, and so therefore they should be destroyed. That it's right there in the name, Homo superior.
Yeah, they feel threatened by the mutants. Exactly. Not that they want to cleanse the world. It's not about purifying it, you know, or whatever. It's just about living. They feel under threat, you know. And that's, remember, one of the things that Kate talked about was that they were honest concerns. Yeah. He wasn't a horrible person, but his death and the stance he had when he died and who killed him led to this cultural backlash where they just freaked out about the mutants. Mm-hmm. So in the back of this hearing, you know, it's crowded, it's, you know, tons of people attending, but Storm, Colossus, and Kitty arrive, and they sort of slip in the back, and of course Professor X instantly notices them and communicates telepathically, calling out to Storm, "What are you doing here? Is something wrong?" And you might say that, Professor X just straight up opens her mind, or, you know, asks her to, but does a mind check on her, see what's going on.
Yeah.
And obviously instantly is aware of what this situation is. Meanwhile, the Senator Kelly is questioning Moira. And this is a good line, and this is Moira at first. Senator, in all honesty, I fail to see the need for this hearing or your concern.
Right.
And his response is, the need is simple, Dr. McTaggart. I merely wonder if, in a world of beings like Dr. Doom, Magneto, the Fantastic Four, the Avengers, and Lord knows how many others, there's any place for ordinary men and women. I wonder as well, Doctor, if this same question wasn't asked by the last Neanderthal about the first Cro-Magnon. And at that moment, the back of the hearing, the wall starts cracking and splitting,
yeah,
comes down, and who's there? It's the Brotherhood. So this is the moment. The X-Men instantly suit up, and we've got a face-off. It's the last page of the issue, and, you know, a fun little cliffhanger, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? At this point, if I had to wait, you know, the next 2 weeks or the next month or whatever the, you know, release schedule was on X-Men at the time,
you'd be bumped.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
But luckily, since this is like 34 years old, it's
in the
trade.
Year
2000.
We don't. And so on to Uncanny X-Men 142. Another cool cover. This time the Sentinel with Storm sort of gripped in his hand and blasting the ever-loving crud out of Wolverine, sort of incinerating his skin off and stuff.
And not only does Storm have... is gripped by the Sentinel, but she also has something coming out of her back, if you'll notice,
too. Yes, she does.
Too.
She does. So, she has what appears to be the shaft of some spear or bowl or something coming right out of her, you're right.
And this, you know, I just kind of want to, you know, maybe bring up real shortly that this is from an era of comic books where what happens in the comic would actually make it onto the cover. Like, yeah, you know, if you think about today's covers, they're really awesome, but sometimes they have nothing to do with what's really going on inside, you know?
Right.
So
I always remember, I think it was an issue of Runaways with Wolverine on the cover, and you flip the book upside down and the back of it says Wolverine does not appear in this issue. It was the most ridiculous thing. And it wasn't a joke. He didn't appear. He was on the cover. They felt the need to put a warning. Totally hilarious.
Yeah.
Now, one of the funny things is, you know, this is sort of the, remember from Batman, the changing sound of the explosion from one issue to the next. We get a little bit of that here. The first page of issue 142 says the name of the story is Mind Out of Time. But you know, if you flip back to the very last page of 141, it says Next Time Out of Mind.
Right.
I wonder if one of those was a, you know, a misprint or a typo or, you know, whatever kind of thing, a mistake, or maybe they changed their minds. Mind out of time, time out of mind.
I don't know. Yeah.
Do you like one better than the other?
I actually like Mind Out of Time better because it plays on, you know, Kate's consciousness being sent back to another time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think
Time Out of Mind is sort of like you're chilling and you're not worried about the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's out of mind.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mind Out of Time, I think, is much more appropriate.
Yeah.
In my opinion. But hey, you know, whatever. They decide to play it safe and go with both.
Yes.
So at one point or another.
Indeed they did. So. Yeah. I really do like this first page, and I think it's got a good design. You've got Kitty Pryde in her sort of, or Kate, whoever, in her original X-Men outfit. And on the left-hand side of the page, you've got the 1980s X-Men faced off against the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. And then on the right-hand side of the page, you've got the year 2013 and a bunch of the Sentinels, you know, chasing down the remaining X-Men. And I think it is a really nice page. It's well designed. It might not be J.H. Williams, but this is pretty good stuff.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So it's sort of setting up, you know, the two narratives, what's going on outside the Senate and what's going on in New York in the future. And first, we get a look at what's happening in 1980, and it is the face-off, Pyro, Avalanche, the Blob, Destiny, and what's his name? Pyro, yeah. You know, and of course, Mystique faced up against Nightcrawler, Wolverine, Storm, Kate Pryde, I'll go with, Colossus, and Angel. And a little bit of shouting, and then the tussle starts. And another one of these long extended sequences and every move, you know, Pyro's able to form his flame into this hand and he's, you know, going after Colossus.
Trying to grip Colossus, that's yeah. Right.
Wolverine swoops in and is going to skewer him. And, you know, Storm thinking that there's a lot of witnesses to what's going on. And right. No matter if it's an evil mutant or a good human or whatever, they don't want to display too much violence here and really just worsen their cause.
Yeah.
So she throws a little tornado out of there and separates Wolverine from Pyro. Meanwhile, up in the skies,
Angel is getting Kitty out of there.
Yes, he is. He is. And similarly, Moira and Professor X go to make their escape from the scene. And, a police lady with suspiciously black blue hair sort of evacuates them out of there. And of course, it is Mystique. She had, what was it? She's got a damper field of her own to sort of keep Professor X from reading her mind until it's too late. Of course, she gets him out, gasses him, and then hooks back up with Destiny.
And, you know, this is one of those times, too, where villains just don't make the best choices. You know, she outright says, "You are my most dangerous foe, Xavier. I should kill you while I have the chance. But for the moment, I think you're more used as a potential hostage."
Yeah.
Not even as a hostage, a potential hostage.
That's right.
So, I mean, it's like
the most powerful telepath in the world. You've got a chance to kill him. You're like, "Yeah, give him around. Maybe I'll trade him."
You know. No. No, you take your shot.
When Destiny and Mystique are talking here, we do get an interesting bit. Of course, Destiny can see the future. And so Mystique's like, you know, "How fares our future, Destiny?" "I am not sure. Beyond a certain point, the images become jumbled, difficult to read. There is a random factor present, Mystique, an anomaly that strikes to the very heart of the time stream. So long as it exists, nothing is certain."
Yeah.
So the anomaly, of course, is Kate.
Yeah.
The consciousness of Kate Pride. And it makes sense that she wouldn't be able to see the future if somebody has traveled, you know, within it and things are changing. And what we'll find is that this ends up mattering quite a bit. We zip back to Kitty going through the sky, sort of recapping events of last issue. And once again, transition to 2013, through that little exposition, with the X-Men on their way, and they do locate the Baxter Building. Storm incapacitates the Guardian Sentinel with a bolt of lightning, and they enter the building, and Wolverine has on his belt buckle. It's kind of funny at the bottom picture. It kind of looks like he's peeing. but instead, it's like a beam of light shooting out of his belt buckle to activate the Fantastic Four's private elevator. But it's just really amusing looking down at it.
Oh, gosh. I didn't even look at it that way the first time I went through this.
It looks like Wolfie's you know, relieving a little stress there. But anyway.
With some high pressure.
That's right.
Because that is shooting straight forward.
Yeah. They get into the elevator, they head up top, and we head back to Washington in 1980, where the battle continues. Storm blows them out of the Senate building onto the streets where the fight continues.
Yeah.
We get Colossus smashed out of the side of a building and the Blob hurling himself down, sort of a belly flop on him, or, you know, cannonball on him. Angel flying, the army showing up, shooting a cannon that ends up hitting Colossus, of course.
Yeah.
And then Pyro turning the army's flamethrowers back on them. Pretty fun. I do think Pyro's power allows for some cool art and some fun scenes in the game. You know, the ability to control fire, and he can make it grow and form these beasts of fire and
sure,
such.
Yeah,
and he certainly does that here.
You know, he uses fire the way that, you know, a Green Lantern would use their ring.
Right,
you know,
right.
Anything he can imagine, he can form the fire into that.
Absolutely. That's right. And then Kurt gets attacked by Kurt.
Yes.
We get two Nightcrawlers on this page. You know, Nightcrawler looks up and there's another Nightcrawler leaping at him, claiming that, no, he's really Nightcrawler. You know, what are these scenes? No, I'm the real Nightcrawler. I'm Spartacus. Anyway, they go at it. Meanwhile,
Wolverine's having some words with Storm.
Yeah.
Because he is not completely happy with her leadership here.
Yes, yeah, it's true. It's true. You know, she's trying to live up to Cyclops and, of course, Professor X. She has her own doubts, of course, but doesn't take the guff from Wolverine that he wants to dish out.
She at the end of the day, he's not happy with the decision, but the claws just retract right into his.
I am the leader of the X-Men. While that is so, you will use your claws when I command. No other time. I wouldn't take that from Cyclops. You will take it from me. You possess speed, strength. Your unbreakable adamantium skeleton makes you nearly invulnerable. You should not need your claws, except in the most extreme of situations, against the deadliest and most powerful of foes. And Wolverine does concede. All right, Storm, I'll do it your way.
Yeah.
For now. This conversation ain't finished, not by a long shot.
Right. And, you know, I would argue that maybe trying to stop the Brotherhood is an extreme situation, and they are deadly foes, and they're trying to save the world.
That's true.
So
I think, and it wasn't saying it right there, but I think she was worried about the public perception that it was such, you know, a big moment, and she didn't want him shish kebab and pyro earlier, you know?
Yeah.
But Avalanche comes up. You know, he's sort of a forgotten villain. You don't really see much of him, but he was in the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. He's like the fifth Beetle. You know, nobody believes him. You weren't in the Brotherhood, dude. I swear I was in the Brotherhood. Man, we'd fight the X-Men. I fought the X-Men. Sure you have, Avalanche. Sure you have. Anyway.
No one pays attention to Avalanche.
That's right. You know, just another more pages of this. The battle's going on. I'm going to sort of skip through a little bit of it. But, you know, at the end, it's sort of an interesting moment. And another bit of research I haven't done. But we get this panel at the top where Mystique does start to reveal her true form. I think she just got hit. And Nightcrawler, you know, Ungbleich. I have no idea how to read that German. You're Mystique. Your skin, your eyes. If this is indeed your true form, mein Gott, we are so alike. Could it be, Kurt Wagner, that you are not so unique as you once thought? You know my name. Who are you? Ask your mother, Marcelise Ardus. Who would know better than she? And I wonder if... What she's sort of implying there, is she implying that maybe she is Margulies Ardus and is Nightcrawler's mom?
Possibly.
Mean, you know, I'm not sure how to read that. I sort of, my intention was to sort of look up or whatnot. You know, life happens, but if they have some familial relationship in the canon. But regardless, this panel, I also remember I had I don't know if you remember the official index to the Marvel Universe they used to have, and I had a few issues of those years ago, and this image was under Mystique, you know, and this image was in that comic, so as soon as I got to it, I was like, oh, cool, that's from back in the day. Anyway, she skimpers off, Raven does. Mystique, and X-Men realize that they don't know where Senator Kelly is.
Right.
And there's sort of a little mini cliffhanger within the book, because we jump back to 2013. The X-Men, you know, Wolverine, Storm, and Colossus, of course, arriving at the top of the Baxter building. They exit the elevator, and think they're sneaking up on the Sentinel. Get another fastball special going on. And unfortunately, the batter returns it. The Sentinel turns right around and vaporizes.
Wolverine.
I mean, you got this skin and flesh just ripping off his skeleton. Just another awesome bit of death in this book. It is pretty awesome.
And, you know, I think at this point in the story, too, This is very much so the death of Wolverine. So I think it's assumed that this blast destroyed every last strand of DNA that Wolverine has. He's not going to regen from this. I mean, it even says, you know, on the cover, if you go back to where he's being blasted on the cover,
yeah.
You know, everyone dies. Or whatever the caption is, everybody dies, everyone. But it's
pretty awesome.
Yeah, everybody dies. But it's not often you see the death of Wolverine in a comic book.
Indeed, whether it's an alternate future or not, right. You know, this guy dies hard. You know, the very next page, the first panel, you can sort of see Logan's skeleton there. And, you know, I notice that, of course, his skeleton's been wrapped in adamantium, but it's a very mechanical looking adamantium. It doesn't look organic. It looks more industrial, the skeleton. And I don't know where I got this from, if it was from the movies or what the deal was, but I sort of imagined his skeleton and the adamantium around it looking a little bit more organic, either that it had just been layered with the adamantium, except at the joints or something, or that it was more just wrapped around each bone, sort of in circles or something like that to reinforce it.
Yeah.
And, you know, seeing it so robotic looking in this just sort of caught me off guard. But, you know,
it definitely does look like a robot arm.
Yeah.
Of some sort.
Like a T-1000 or something. Yeah. Or a T-800, I guess. T-800. Yeah.
The Arnold model.
That's right. So Storm flips out, throws a lightning bolt, but unfortunately more Sentinels are coming. And that little cover, Storm gets hers now. It seems to shoot a spear almost out of its finger where the Sentinels does. And
you could say that the Sentinel gave her the bird.
Yeah, indeed. It is coming out of his middle finger. That's hilarious. Yeah. And in silhouette, in black silhouette, we get Storm being pierced by this missile of sorts.
And this leads to a pretty emotional moment with Colossus here.
Yes.
Because we get the narration, Peter Rasputin was never... was ever a gentleman, a man of peace, a man who, like the woman he holds in his arms, thought life the most precious of gifts and love the most precious celebration of that gift. And it goes on to explain that Storm was a sister to him. And basically this sweetheart that basically Claremont's made him out to be, his hands red with their blood. He screams, and moments later, when he feels himself gripped by a murderous berserker fury to rival Wolverine's, he welcomes it. He is pissed.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how he does this, but the following panel, the tears streaming out of his eyes in the first panel, the last panel, a Sentinel being launched out the side of the buildings. I don't know if he just ran and sort of rammed him, you know, with his shoulder or whatnot, but man, he brings it because the Sentinels are big.
Yeah.
They're heavy. They're giant. And of course, where is Kitty? Is a thing I was thinking as I read this. Well, she is being cradled by Rachel, maybe Rachel Summers, you know, who as a telepath has just sensed the death of all her comrades.
Yeah.
So she's crying over the unconscious body of Kitty Pryde. Back to 1980. And this is the pivotal moment. Destiny cornering Robert Kelly, a crossbow aimed at him. And at the last moment, Kitty phases through and knocks Destiny away. The crossbow bolt shoots into the wall.
Yeah.
And that's it. We're saved.
History's changed.
Done. History has changed. And
her consciousness, it looks like, goes back.
That's right.
Right? You got the polka dots show up again that I can't see.
The concentric circles.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, Kitty's consciousness returns to her body. And, you know, we don't get the future, Kate, what's happened. You know, we don't get that. Instead, it's Raven, Darkholme, you know, noticing Destiny being captured, the X-Men returning on Warren Worthington's jet, realizing that, you know, Senator Kelly has been saved, you know, that they've done it. And the last page, an epilogue, you know, kind of a fun moment. A month has passed, and Senator Kelly's committee has finished its hearings and submitted its report to the president. Now, on a chill December evening, both Kelly and his good friend, industrialist Sebastian Shaw, who, unknown to Kelly, is both a mutant and a supervillain himself, are summoned to the White House. And, you know, they used to have this convention, and we see it here, of, like, the president not being entirely visible so he could be anybody, you know? He is silhouetted. He is sort of in the shadows. Yeah. Nowadays, they just make somebody who looks, like, sort of like Obama or sort of like Clinton, or they just draw Obama or Clinton or whoever, Bush, and they just go with it. But back in the day, they never used to do that. And then, of course, we get Henry Peter Gyrich. And, of course, they've got a scheme. They've got a covert operation, Project Wide Awake.
Yeah.
And it doesn't bode well. The Sentinels, they are going to be made.
Yes.
So although they save themselves from that particular future, we still get giant killer, mutant killer robots, which is awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
For us.
Exactly.
Not so good for them.
So, was it worth it?
Well, for me, the things I liked the most about this story was, you know, the elements of it, what it introduced. You know, the Sentinels are awesome. This, you know, future, this, it's become a big part of X-Men going on. And, you know, part of the X-Men to me is like looking back and it's always been sort of taken off of the Holocaust and sort of, you know, people who are looked down on by society and who are on the run. And this issue also, it doesn't just look back to the Holocaust, but it looks forward to a future world where this could be reality. The ending is cool that they still leave this as a possible enemy, a possible threat.
Yeah.
You know, some of the art really is good. I mean, the death moments, to me, that's when it is, when the Sentinels are zapping these guys. It's awesome looking,
right. You
know, Franklin Richards and Wolverine, of course, very cool. I also like time travel stories, and this one did it in a unique way. It was simply the consciousness swapping, so that was interesting. What about you?
No, I mean, I dug it. I love John Byrne's art. Yeah. John Byrne, fantastic art. A little bit of a jerk in real life, but as an artist, fantastic.
Is he?
Real, yeah. Oh gosh,
it's
yeah.
Like best buds with Todd McFarlane or something.
Worse.
Worse. Yeah.
Worse. But no, you know, I appreciate Chris Claremont's style. It's not my favorite style in the world, but I think it is kind of fun to read it. I wouldn't want every comic book I read to be like how Claremont does things with the super extended dialogue, the thought bubbles everywhere, and them plainly explaining what they're doing in their actions. Right. But I think sometimes that is enjoyable to read. I definitely think that Days of Future Past is one of those cases. I enjoyed the time elements. And one thing I liked about this versus the movie is once history has changed, they don't go back to the future so that they can drop the ball.
Well, yeah, let's just talk about the movie. Kevin and I have both seen it. And certainly at this point, we're going to just spoil the movie.
Yeah. So if you've not watched the movie and you don't want spoilers, we're done talking about the issues. We're in full movie spoiler mode.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Dumbledore dies. No, anyway, there are obviously some big differences in the movie. Yeah. It's not Kitty who goes back. It's Wolverine. And what they explain in the movie is that, you know, only he is, you know, with his healing factor, is the only one capable of surviving the experience.
Yeah.
That was fine with me. You sort of pointed out that it gave them a good excuse to have him on screen more.
Yeah, I think, it's more Hugh Jackman.
Yeah, and it's more Wolverine, because I think Hugh Jackman, whatever you think about him, because especially among comic fans, the opinion is extremely divided. But even if it was a comic, you know, I think nowadays, editorial might say, hey, instead of Kitty, let's do Wolverine. Because Wolverine is popular, so I don't really... The Hugh Jackman part I'll sort of overlook, but you know, Wolverine. They had sort of more cool exotic locations, like you know, they visit Moscow and they're in China, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Bishop shows up.
Bishop was so good.
Yeah, that was a fun treat. And of course, Bishop visually has the mutant M tattooed on his face. Yeah. And although they weren't tattooed here, they do have these sort of jumpsuits, the prison suits with the M's that they all have to wear.
Yeah.
And then, of course, tattoo makes sense because, you know, the Jews in the Holocaust were, of course, tattooed by the Nazis.
Right.
Those are some fun things. Kevin, what did you not like about the movie?
The last 5 minutes.
The last 5 minutes.
Okay, so Wolverine and the rest of them, and really not even Wolverine, Professor X and the people that are already there, Human Beast, are the ones that save the day.
The future?
Yeah, or in the past. Wolverine gets tossed into water and is drowning or whatever. He doesn't save the day. but no, so... Wolverine, at one point in the movie, there's a scene. The thing with him to keep that connection to the past is he can't think traumatic thoughts, right? He's, you know, they kind of make the point, I think jokingly at first, that, you know, think positive or whatever. And he has some flashbacks to his Weapon X days. And so that just breaks sort of the chain between the future and the past. That consciousness from the future consciousness goes back to the future, and the past consciousness comes back to that room that he was in 1973. And he's like, what's going on here? So they've established the fact that the old consciousness can indeed return to that body, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that lasts for a few minutes. Wolverine ends up calming down and Katie gets a grip on things and is able to send him back into the past. And then future Wolverine's back in the past. The story goes on. The X-Men saved the day. The history's saved or what have you. And the movie cuts back to the future. And
this is the alternate new future.
The alternate
that's
new
been
future,
caused
the changed
by,
future.
Yeah, right.
Yes. And so Wolverine with his Polly from Sopranos hair wakes up in bed, and he's a little bit confused about where he is at first. He steps out into the hallway.
He's obviously in the mansion.
Yeah, Beast walks by. Frasier Beast walks by. He sees Rogue down the hallway, what have you. And he walks downstairs to go see the professor in his office, Professor X. In the doorway is Jean Grey.
Right.
Still alive.
Yeah.
There's a little moment between her and Wolverine, almost, that is then interrupted by...
Cyclops
is back.
Yeah.
X-Men 3 never happened.
Yes.
Never happened. Those two characters are back.
Which I think most people would say is fine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now you can just throw it out of your DVD collection if you were foolish enough to buy it in the first place.
Well, it's now an alternate reality.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, for sure. And so anyway, Wolverine ends up having this conversation with Professor X.
Yeah.
And I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Professor X reads Wolverine's mind and detects that this is indeed the same Wolverine from that future that was changed.
I don't think he does a whole mind meld kind of crazy over the top thing.
But he can just.
But he is aware of that Wolverine is not the Wolverine who went to bed last night. That it's different, and that, you know, when Wolverine was back in the 1973. First of all, that's the difference. The movie takes place in the early time is 1973 with awesome costume design,
and we do see the president.
Yes.
And the president is without a doubt Richard Nixon.
Yes, yes. It
great
is Richard
actor,
Nixon.
Whoever that guy was.
He was really funny.
Yeah.
And anyway, Wolverine has a time and they're talking about, you know, the future, that things are going to be changed. And Wolverine says to young Professor X, like, you need to get us together. Whatever happens, you need to form the X-Men. You need to search out. And he like names all these different X-Men for him to one day find.
Yeah.
So Professor X knew that at some point, years from now, you know, Wolverine, this past Wolverine might zip back to the future.
Yeah.
And I got to deal with that. I got to be aware of that. And so I think he was just pretty dang smart and quitty, pretty quick on the uptake and just realize what happened. I don't remember specifically if there's some kind of evidence or sign that he's actually, you know, reading his mind.
I don't think that. Maybe like a slight change in the expression on his face.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But it's obvious that he does understand what just happened.
The dialogue made it pretty clear that he picks up the, and I think he even says, right, welcome back, old friend.
Right.
So,
yeah, I think you're right.
Now to me, when the future is changed, we see Professor X is about to be killed by a Sentinel, right? And right before the blast hits him, Magneto's being killed, Storm's being killed, Bishop's being killed. They're all dead, 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 dead. And Professor X is about to join them. And then the room just wipes clear. It's like a battle never happened. There's no characters there. There's no parts of Sentinels or whatever. Wipe.
Yeah.
So that implies that those characters, in conjunction with what the characters that Wolverine's talking to in Professor X's school, that that reality never happened. Never happened. The 70s characters aged progressively through the timeline. It got to the point to where he woke back up at. Now then. If that's the case, if they were all wiped and that reality never happened, I think one of two things should have happened. One, future Wolverine consciousness wiped too, because he would have never existed at that point because he just changed his own history.
Right.
So 1973 consciousness should have woke back up underwater and would have been like, what the hell's going on? And then he would have just lived out the rest of his life and whatever happened in the alternate timeline that they've created. Or option two, his consciousness is stuck in the past. 1973 consciousness is screwed. Just whatever, just disappeared. You're being inhabited. Get over it. And future Wolverine is just going to relive these alternate years and get up to that point. Instead, what happens is he wakes up in bed, not quite realizing where he is. It takes him a minute, figures it out. And goes talks to Professor X as this future Wolverine. What happened to the Wolverine that went to bed the night before? Who was that Wolverine living all through? Was that the 1973 consciousness? Did he come back, relive all those years, and then he's just screwed that fateful morning?
Yeah, that morning he wakes up. I absolutely took it as his consciousness was switched back immediately with the other one. So, like, yes, the 1973, where it's 1972. It's Wolverine. He's running around. And then in the future, they're going to come back and swap time. So that one goes to the future and he is on hold. He is unconscious, being sedated or whatever, you know, Kitty Pryde has a weird power where she's like, you know, sending him back. It's kind of strange, but, and he's just on hold. And as the very moment that, you know, the reality changes, he swaps back to his body, as you were saying, he'd been drowning or whatever, and the other one goes forward. I think your objections are fair and reasonable, but they, first of all, this is a fantastic story.
It is.
So, you know, we don't have rules for this stuff, but within the context of the story, it is explained early on that Wolverine will have these memories. And so it didn't bother me because I was expecting it the entire movie that that is what's going to happen, is that he lives his life. I mean, remember, this Wolverine in the future, he doesn't know the last, whatever it was, 30 years. He remembers a different last 30 years. So he is a man in an incorrect timeline for himself. He does have memories. They just didn't happen anymore.
But if those other characters in that original future timeline where the Sentinels are taken over, whatever, if those characters, if those consciousness never happened, right? And if that Wolverine's consciousness was taken out of that body and 73 came back and relived those years, and then the future one, shouldn't be there.
No, it did happen though. It did happen. It was changed, and we have two alternate realities. And although the reality of, like, Marvel 616 or whatever you want to call it is now this new reality, that still happened. We watched the movie. There isn't necessarily one reality. The timeline split, and both realities exist in some kind of weird way.
Okay, so
they both exist.
Well, that original reality, what happened to those characters then? Why did they disappear? If that still happened.
I don't know. It's just some alternate. I mean, you just have splits here. The fact
is, it's
not
a split. They literally disappeared from the screen. They were never there to begin with because history changed.
It could have split off and rejoined. I mean, you could imagine it as a timeline where for a little while it branches off and there's an alternate history, and then it rejoins. and it becomes that one. And there's this alternate of these two different ways it could have existed. And in the end, it's the same one reality. But those times, I mean, the fact that Wolverine remembers indicates in some way that it happened. You know, even if he forgot, you might say it still happened, and maybe that's debatable, but he remembers it. And it's not true anymore. It's not an experience that he can share with anybody. Nobody in his new reality in the future, the new future, nobody knows about this War of the Sentinels, or at least the war that Wolverine experienced. But...
then
does that make sense, at least? You hear what I'm saying?
But I think if he's going to teleport to a point in time, if that's just got to happen, I think it should be in that alternate reality.
Yeah. And honestly, it may have been better storytelling if, you know, if that had happened. It may have been in a more emotional thing.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. It didn't bother me as much as it obviously bothered you.
Yeah. Because I was really super enjoying the movie at that point, and everything was clicking. Everything made sense. And then, you know, when I watch these, I don't just turn off my, you know, brain or whatever. I'm not thinking, does this make sense? Okay, I guess this does. And then, freaking, that just took me out of it.
I'm sorry, my brain was turned off. Could you say that?
No, it did break the experience.
No, it's a pity, because I think the movie was overall pretty dang good. I had a fun time watching it.
Yeah, my suspension of disbelief could only go so far.
Dude, apparently it got about 93% of the movie.
It's an excellent movie, and I'll probably go see it again.
Right.
But I just thought that could have been played out differently and should have been.
Now, on a more positive note, I really dug the Quicksilver scenes. That was so amusing and funny. Quicksilver just running around rooms, pushing cops' hands so that they punch themselves at thunderous speed, moving bullets that are just barely moving millimeters in the air with his little finger, pushing them to block the bullets from Magneto and such. Really fun.
Yeah.
That was cool. Magneto at the end lifting the stadium. That was a fun move. There's a lot I enjoyed about it.
There was good eye candy in there with the visual effects and everything. There was good storytelling. You know, I cared about every major character on screen.
Yeah.
You know, there was some sort of emotional connection, and I was rooting for some people and booing other people, not literally in the theater, because that would have been rude, but you know, there were
villains and such.
I was emotionally invested into the story and enjoyed it, but it was just that one small part where Wolverine wakes up and he is who he is, and that.
I hear you.
Maybe there'd be a director's cut. Maybe the director's with me, and he was like, "This is how I wanted it." But then Fox came in, and it was the X3 guys that came in and did it.
That's right. But of course, X3 doesn't have to exist anymore. Right. So maybe they did it themselves. Maybe they were like, "Our movie was such an abomination. Let's retcon this."
No. But anyway, that's the comic. That's the movie.
Yeah. Good stuff.
I believe next time you hear from us, we're going to be diving into Superior Spider-Man.
Yeah, I think that's the plan. And I was excited that you had some interest in it, because, of course, I've enjoyed it. And I think it'll be fun. I guess we'll start with just volume one of Superior Spider-Man.
Sure. Which I believe is 5 or 6 issues, the standard for a trade paperback.
Yeah.
Dr. Octopus is Spider-Man.
It's going to be
red.
It's going to be hilarious is what it's going to be. It is a dang funny book.
But
very cool.
Anyway, I guess plugs real quick.
Yeah.
As always, do you have any?
You know, guys, hit up our Stormcrow Facebook page. Give us a like. Leave us some comments. Really like to see you on there. That's my plug, you know.
Cool. Yeah. Me, as always, check out 336cast.com. It's where you're going to find the three beards. It's where you're going to find previous episodes of Stormcrow Comic Cast. That's where you're going to find Name Redacted. That's where you're going to find Post Thumbs. That's where you're shortly going to find Midnight. And, of course, did I mention the 336cast in any of that? If I did, you're hearing it twice. But 336cast.com, lots of good podcast goodness on there. And I think that's... yeah, that pretty much covered it all. So, as always, thank you for doing the podcast with me.
Thanks for doing the show with me. We'll see you guys next week.
Superior Spider-Man Volume 1 coming up.
Hell yeah.
Bye.
Bye.